Yes, I am.
Okay. We're on. Get it.
She's not like anyone else. You wonder why she captured you like a firefly and makes you shine like you never could alone.
Hey everybody, welcome to Drive-Thru HR, Brian Wimp and William Tincup and the lovely Nisha, bringing this to you every single day, talking about HR with the HR folks. So, William, the sun is shining today, there is magic in the air. How about a little further south, what about for you?
It is gorgeous down here as well, and there is magic in the air, Brian. Change is in the air, magic is in the air, and all is well.
That is great. Well, you know what? We definitely need to get to our guest because he has got some stuff that I can't wait to hear. So, Sam Durgle, welcome to Drive-Thru HR again.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Pleasure to be back.
Good to have you back on. We had a good, great conversation last time, and you got a voice for radio. So
thank you.
We got an equation
for radio too, but that's okay.
Hey, well, no judging, no judging. Not everybody can be model-like, like William and myself.
Like William, okay.
Check out Facebook. I mean, the picture it says it all right there.
Understood.
So. Well, if you would, just kick it off. Introduce yourself to our millions of listeners, and we'll go into what's top of mind after that.
Thank you very much. My name is Samuel Durgle. I work in executive search with Stanton Chase International. We're a global search firm, and what I do is I deal with human resource professionals every day, and it's a pleasure to have an opportunity to speak to the mass of them. So thank you about that.
What is what's top of mind for you these days? What's kind of keeping you up at night?
Well, I specialize in CFO executive search. In our last conversation, we talked about the relationship between human resources and finance, and that the synergies are there, and it really needs to work. What I'd like to talk about this time is the HR and retained executive search. Where does it come in? What's the need for it? Why do people choose it? In preparing for our show, I reached out to some of the HR professionals I know and informally surveyed them. This is certainly not a scientific survey, but what it did allow is for some feedback on the relationship, and I have some thoughts to share.
Bring it.
Excellent. So, you know, one question I asked my HR executives was, is how often have they used retained executive search in the last 12 months? And two-thirds of them said that they have, which is a good number to know as someone that sells retained executive search. But also, as HR professionals, I speak to many HR professionals and sell to many HR professionals and helping them deal with their senior talent needs. And sometimes there's a reluctance to use retained executive search. And understanding that reluctance is important for me because my goal is to make a difference to the companies that I work with and provide them with the excellent senior talent that they need to be able to be successful. So knowing that they generally are not afraid of using retained executive search is a good thing. The next thing that I looked at with my informal survey was I want to understand why they chose to use retained executive search for a mandate for hiring a senior executive. So the number one reason that they gave by far was the requirement to find the best talent possible. It's not always evident that companies are looking for the best talent. In many cases, they're satisfied with good enough. But when companies are really, in my experience, really need the best senior and executive level talent, they using retained executive search is certainly valuable. The other two top reasons were the need for a confidential search to replace somebody that's in the role, and managing it internally, even with all the resources, just causes too many problems. And also the need for independence in the search process. So too many times there are, at a senior level, there are politics that are being played with, and possibly power trips to be able to put one person in or a type of person in. And going outside the firm really helps human resources make sure that there's an impartiality to the choice, and that's very helpful. And HR professionals believe that's an important reason.
You know, it's funny, in preparation for this, that's some of the things that I was thinking about is like triaging when to make the decision, when to use the outside, retained search, for what positions, mm-hmm. and also how much. Like, if someone's never using, an outside retained search, I'm sure they have no idea, like, how it's priced.
Yes.
So, I mean, I think you've already tackled some of the when and what. How do you kind of help people navigate, especially the first timers, the how much part of that?
Yeah, I mean, the companies that are in growth mode may not have had the opportunity to use retained executive search, and mostly those are the kinds of companies that I see that are using it for the first time. They've grown by, LinkedIn ads and all those good things because they just needed people and good enough was great. But when a company is moving from good to great, it's ensuring that they have the best talent. And when hiring wrong is more expensive than writing a check. Retained executive search is very expensive, and I sell and deliver a very high value item. It's there's a commitment up front. So generally, the way retained executive search works is that we charge a third of the first year's annual compensation. And we bill that a third up front as a retainer, and that's why it's called retained executive search, a third in the middle of the search and a third at the end. On a $300,000 position, that's $100,000 in fees. And in a growth company where cash is important, writing a check for $100,000 is a lot of money. So the question really comes down to is, is that worth it? As someone that sells and delivers it, absolutely worth it. There's the right time to choose it, and not every search requires retained executive search. It's important to choose it for the right reasons. But for strategic, critical positions of the company, absolutely. There may be a cash flow issue that stops companies from doing it, but I'd like to talk about one thing, and I'd like your input. LinkedIn. I love LinkedIn. LinkedIn's a great tool. I use it myself, but it's a tool. And people have this belief that LinkedIn, all you need to do is put a position up on LinkedIn and you'll get talent. You do get talent. But it goes back to the conversations that happened with Monster and, all that. That you're able to find those that are looking. So number one, you're only getting active candidates, not passive candidates, and you're not looking for what you need. And that's only one part of the search process. People believe that finding people is the key part to the search process. It's one of the six or seven steps of a successful search.
Nice. Let me ask about the expectations of your clients. How do you manage, in terms of, I want someone that's been there and done that. So I want a gal or a guy that, I don't have to teach them how to do this. Let's say it's a COO position. They've mm-hmm. they've run operations. They've just mm-hmm. they've got the gray hairs to prove it and all the shark bites to prove it. I want someone that's been there and done that. How do you manage the expectations of that person that you need to find, but also you know, all of their either crazy expectations or otherwise, but how do you manage client expectations?
Upfront, in the beginning, in having the conversation as to what's required and what's expected. I mean, in many cases, a company is calling me because they want to hire a blue box with the red ribbon of a certain size, and they want to see different red, you know, red box and blue box with a red ribbon of different size, of the same size, and they want to see cookie cutters. I want to see five that are the same. You know, they want to hire the persons that are in the job at their direct competitor. What I try to tell them is that, you know, we'll have a conversation with that person, but we're going to take a look at other people who can get the job done, number one. Number two, fit. Huge component that too many people, when they're in the environment themselves, can't necessarily understand what's required by fit and culture fit. There's certainly technical aspects of the job, but when you're hiring an executive, okay, it's not just about what they can do tactically. It's about leadership. It's about how they deal with other people. Will that work in your environment? There's so many issues that need to be addressed. And that sometimes, you know, when there's a person that's recommended by an executive in the company or a board member saying, you know, this person could be good for the job, interview them and let's bring them on board. You know, in a private company, maybe, in a public company, definitely not a good thing. But in reality, it's, you know, the question needs to be asked. Do we want to hire the best person for this role? And the second question is, what does that mean? What is the best person for this role? You have to take the time up front to figure that out. And that's the key part where we help.
How do you size people up? So you've got your list. You kind of boil it to the four or five that you really like, but you're going to make recommendations on two or three, whatever the numbers are. How do you size people up? Are you using assessments? Are you using, you know, interview, kind of the black box interview technique? Like, what are you doing to kind of separate all of the would-be's from the two or three that you really feel strongly they could pick any of them and they're going to be good?
It's a mix. You know, we make a first slate recommendation. To get to that first slate recommendation, we're reaching out to a lot of people to assess interest, assess appropriateness. You know, we spend a lot of time up front trying to identify from various sources who could be appropriate for this role. And then we screen first, we do our interviews first, and then we assess whether they're appropriate to be put in front of them. The interview is a mixture between structured interviewing as well as being in the profession long enough, you're able to read people very, very well, and that's a key part. So that's what gets them to the list. And then from the list, it's, you know, we, in cases where our clients are not necessarily savvy enough, it could be the executive in many cases in terms of how to properly structure an interview. So we identify based on what they're looking for to be able to guide them in terms of asking the right questions in that interview. We get to the first level interview and then the second level interview, and then we do assessments.
Nice. Take our audience into the talent pool these days. So we've had a recession. Depending on who you talk to, we're coming out of the recession. The baby boomers are all going to retire on Tuesday. You know, what's the talent pool for, you know, the executives that you're looking to fill? What's it look like today?
There are lots of people that can do. The job at a technical level. So, much of the work that I go out and I sell is CFO. So, there are many people that have been CFO, do CFO, but are they the appropriate CFO for this business? But in the end, there are lots of people out there that are CFOs. So, going back to where you started this whole conversation today and you asked how today was, there's change in the air. There's been change in the air for a very long time, and it continues to exist. Change drives my business. When companies change, talent, senior level talent changes, and the need for new talent exists. Executives don't last in a company for a very long time. Sometimes they may last for a long time, but generally, you know, especially when it comes to CFOs, I'll say that a CFO will last in a company an average of 3 years. And then things change, or they move on, or whatever the case may be. So so to be able to answer your question, it's I need to reorient me because I went off on a tangent.
Let me do a quick reset here. Everybody listening to Drive Through HR, we are on. It's William, Brian, and Isha on with Samuel Durgle talking about some different aspects of CFO that we don't typically talk about on the show. So good angle on that. Kind of take you go a little bit of a different direction. So
sure, please.
You're in the CFO world and been in there a long time. So who do you think and why should they? Where should HR report into in the organizational structure? Where's the best, optimal place, wish list place, break convention, stick with convention? Where should they report into actually be the most dialed in and effective for the business operations?
In a large enough organization, it should be the CEO. I firmly believe that. In mid-size or smaller organizations, in many cases, it does end up under finance. Because finance is not only finance, but it's finance and all other administrative items. That's how it usually turns out. HR, whether they report into finance or they don't report into finance, is a partner with finance. And the way I'd like to take a look at it is that they have to work together. And you know, one has the pulse on the money and one has the pulse on the people. But when, you know, most of the budget is a people cost, then they're really talking, they really need to talk off the same page.
Nice. Hey, Sam, a quick question from the Twitter sphere. In terms of CFOs, the most important characteristic in a CFO, what is that?
They have to understand the business. Really understand the business, because everything else is, it comes from there. Successful CFOs are people with a finance background that really understand what drives the business and work with the executives in the business and the partners outside the business to make it work. That's perfect.
Nice. You know what's funny is a lot of people would say that's exactly like HR, right? HR's, if you can just know the business, then a lot of the things, the competencies and skills and everything else kind of come after that, but you got to know the business. And we're a little bit behind the eight ball on that. Let me ask a question about the future of Retain Search. Like we're 10 years ahead and we were looking back at this time. What does Retain Search look like? How does it change over the next 10 years in your estimation?
Interesting. I would say that I'm 43 years old, so in 10 years I'm still going to be in my prime. Retained Executive Search is a very gray-haired business, and there's going to be younger people. People that are coming up the pipe today are going to be in leadership roles in 10 years. They're going to be more media savvy, understand, you know, have a younger approach to the way things are done. So the business is going to change just because the leaders are going to change in the business.
And have you ever seen deals, especially I'm thinking of the Silicon Valley deals that get done where you have kind of a cash and equity kind of play, or a services for equity type play? First of all, have you ever seen those types of deals? Have you ever seen any of them work out?
In terms of the comp and getting paid like that?
Yeah.
I mean, look, if that's how your person's getting paid, then that's how you'll get paid, and that's okay. In the end, it's just different currencies. Cash is an important currency, but there are other currencies and other ways people are willing to get paid, and that's okay.
Is there hotter or slower industries, verticals, sectors, geographies for CFOs? Meaning, manufacturing. If you had to place a healthcare CFO versus a manufacturing CFO, and one was in Tampa versus one was in, I don't know, pick some other place not as cool as Tampa. Do you see anything like when you get something across your desk that you know you're going to be able to fill it just based on the sector and the region that it's in, et cetera?
I can tell you at the executive level, and whether it's CFO or any other position in the United States, most executives will move for right opportunity. Over the past few years, what has held them back is being out of the money in their homes. That's beginning to not be as much of a problem anymore. For the right person, the company will make sure that they're whole on their home to be able to move. There are companies all across this country, in big urban centers, but, in the middle of nowhere, for lack of a better term. And they have, huge organizations with high-quality executives. It doesn't matter. You just move them.
Nice.
Senior executives will move. And also, most of the senior executives I speak to, almost all of them said, my kids are in college now, or they're soon going to be in college. I can do that. They're at a stage in their life where they don't need to be home.
Nice. Let me, if I were applying for a CFO position, let's say I had all the skills and requisites, talent, et cetera. I don't, but let's just say I did.
No, it's fine.
What are some of the things that a CFO, across all of your experience, what do CFOs ask for outside of compensation and benefits? So your typical comp and bennies package, but what are some of the perks that CFOs get that we might be unaware of?
They're numbers people, so they're usually very focused on cash comp and bonus. That's really where they put most of their effort in. I recommend some other things that include budgets for professional development and conferences. That's something that I usually try to recommend. But generally, it's all about cash and upside.
Is there, when you look at pedigrees, is there certain companies that if they've been through, I'm going to say GE, but I have no idea if that's one of them, or if they've been to Wharton or Dartmouth or something like that, or do you look at pedigrees in the same way that we would look at like the top 100 law firms and lawyers? Do you look at schools or even companies as past experience as an indicator to know that they'll be great CFOs?
More, I would say schools, not as much. I would say for smaller companies, having a CPA or CPA training would be important, less so at a larger organization. In reality, it's much more of the experience. One CFO I worked with a long time ago referred to it as a bag of tricks. What do they have in their bag of tricks that they can pull out and use to solve a problem that comes up overnight? because they've seen it before and done it before. So when a company is looking to go through an IPO process, they're going to hire a CFO that's done it once, twice, three times. And that's why they're going to change CFOs. You know, so when strategic changes happen in a company, that's usually what drives a new demand and what they're looking for, especially at the CFO level.
You know, that piggybacks a question around the, you know, the maturity model, early stage growth,
mm-hmm.
high growth,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all decline, maturity, all those other things. Are there certain gals or guys that are just really good at one stage and not as good or just don't care to be good or great at other stages?
Most of them will, you know, you can almost define them like, you know, this is a private equity CFO. This is a restructuring CFO. This is an IPO CFO. Because at a certain level, that's just, they have the experience and the skill set and the value add that they're going to bring to the table that makes it worthwhile paying them that kind of money.
Yeah, and this is Ryan. Totally makes sense because I've been around companies, you know, $250 million company, $200 million company, which is, you know, that's enough revenue that get people's attention, and
mm-hmm.
then going as you ratchet up and you know private to public, and then you ratchet up and you start encroaching on the $1 billion different skill set.
Yes, for sure.
And it just keeps going and going.
You know, and a key part, in addition to what you're saying, what I want to bring up is global. It's very different running a company that's only in the United States versus a company that's really global and what's involved with that. And that certainly at an HR level, I see that. But on the finance level, it's a different kind of organization, beginning to end.
Yeah. Oh, and then the global component. Great point, because that was the other component of probably the level of skill set, maybe sophistication, experience, having a team and resources to pull together because they'd done it before.
Yeah.
In one of my former chapters, exactly what happened, and it definitely made a world of difference to get the new folks in there that really were, you know, a step above, because it's new processes, better people. Not having to look for the answer, they knew the answer. You know, just
mm-hmm.
those kind of toggling, you know, a little quicker on the iterations, on the decision kind of, you know, framework and things. So, okay, we've got about 2 minutes left, and so one final question. And where currently are you drawing inspiration from?
I'm writing a book. I'm writing a book for CFOs. I signed a book deal with Wiley called, tentatively titled, Guide to CFO Success. I have a group of, an advisory group of 85 CFOs that I'm drawing my inspiration from. I'm surveying them every week as I'm putting my book together, and they're providing me with excellent feedback and inspiration. And these are the people that I'm writing the book for, so I'm very inspired.
Well, that absolutely is inspiring. So, well, good. Well, congratulations on that. Can't wait to see that actually evolve, and we'll see, you know, track that. And, folks, we're out of time. One last little shout-out. Got a new friend up in Canada. They run an Impact 99 conference. Check her out. Christine, talked to her a little bit yesterday, and fabulous. Oh my gosh, a great conversation, good connection, friends in common. Who doesn't love them some Canadians? So check them out, and we are out. Samuel, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Both of you. Thank you.
Little bit of Prince.